Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our community, as Dr. Page and Goldstein specialize in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. And now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
On our show today, Adam, we get to talk with Deanne Seekins, director of the Durham VA Medical Center, about quality medical care for our veterans, an important topic and something that's been in the news a lot lately.
You know, Christy, there's been a lot of criticism nationally around the Veterans Administration and the problems that a lot of veterans have faced getting access to care. I've not heard the same problems at the Durham Veterans Administration, but I know it's been a major issue. But I also know from my previous experience that there's been a lot of innovation that has occurred at the Veterans Administration. So I hope we're going to be able to address both issues.
Yeah, but first we have some research that matters. We're going to talk about this concept of not advanced maternal age, but advanced paternal age.
And having new babies, yes.
Right.
About if you have a fracture, your child has a fracture, is ibuprofen as good as more sophisticated or certainly more dangerous drugs like morphine?
And about kids being exposed to unneeded x-rays.
And then finally, would you want a text message to remind you to take your medication?
Okay, well, let's start about should men worry about being too old to have kids?
Well, I wouldn't worry because I'm not going to have any more kids. But at least that's what my wife tells me, and I believe her quite clearly. But, you know, I think this is an interesting question here because we do hear about advancing maternal age, and most people would not say for a woman after age 50, 55, or is she going to have children anymore? But it would not be a question that we would think about. Well, is it okay for a man after age 55 to have children? And, well, biologically, it's probably not a problem as much, but maybe that there are medical questions.
Right. So there is this recent study in Sweden of Swedes born between 1973 and 2001. And what they found were that those children born to fathers who were age 45 and older were more likely to have a variety of different problems such as autism, bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, attention hyperactivity disorder, and also things like having worse grades in school or doing drugs or attempting suicide.
Yeah, you know, it raises all these other kind of questions. And, you know, we had to go look, and there are other research studies that have come out in the last number of years that kind of look at some support, some don't support this finding of as one ages as a man, that perhaps there may be more adverse problems associated with the sperm. And is that clinically relevant? Because there are some benefits to being an older father or
sure,
older parent.
You might be more likely to have a job and have some stability. Or there are all kinds of benefits potentially. And I think the most important thing is if these risks are elevated, the risks are still very low. So there are risks of women having, you know, higher risks of women having certain problems in their children if they're over age 35 or over age 40. But still, it's possible and probable that those things won't happen.
Certainly,
so you don't want to spend too much time worrying about it.
And certainly men who are thinking they may be at an older age before they want to get pregnant with a partner, they could go to a sperm bank and have their sperm frozen at a younger age. So there are other alternatives to waiting to have pregnancy, right? And that would alleviate some of those problems.
Sure.
There's some costs associated with that.
Yeah, there's a lot of costs associated with that. And I think, at least based on what I've seen, I would not encourage people to go be freezing their sperm before age 45. But you know, we'll have further research, I'm sure, and sort it out. But I wouldn't be encouraging people to do that just yet, unless you have a whole lot of money and time, and I don't know.
Too late for me.
Too late for you.
Well, at least the money part and the age, too. Well, let's talk about our next research that matters here, Christy, which is really an important research about children, you know, with pain who have fractures. A couple of my children have had fractures, and at, you know, I think at the time that they had them, I gave them codeine, but that's no longer an option for these young children.
Right. And so this was a study that was published in the Journal of the Canadian Medical Association. That was a randomized, blinded trial, so the people didn't know which kind of medicine they were getting, to see if children who had a fracture or a break of their bone tolerated ibuprofen versus morphine, and if they had any differences in their pain scores.
And the children also rated their pain themselves so that they could see, you know, to what extent their pain was relieved. And what was interesting is that both of the medications did reduce the pain, but there was no significant difference between the ibuprofen or the morphine in terms of how quickly they got a reduction in pain and to what extent they had pain. But there were more adverse side effects with the morphine than the ibuprofen.
Sure. I mean, morphine is a hardcore drug. Even if it's dosed appropriately in children, it's still more likely to make you nauseous or confused or sleepy. And so in this case, this tells me if the ibuprofen works just as well with less side effects, and certainly a safer medication overall, that should be the standard of care, assuming this is true in other studies and with lots of people.
Yeah, this was not probably a large enough study that could detect long-term side effects or other things like bone healing that could be important to a decision. But I think for me, I would probably, for my child today, I'd probably, if asked, I would probably say I'd rather have the ibuprofen.
I certainly would too.
What about our next research that matters?
Also about kids. And this is about kids being exposed to unneeded x-rays. So we know that there is some radiation associated with that and cost and expense and confusion that can come from unneeded x-rays. This was a study done at a Mayo Clinic that looked at 637 chest x-rays in pediatric patients, so birth to 17 years, and found that over the period of time, 2008 to 2014, of the x-rays, 88% of those chest x-rays didn't even influence the treatment plan.
I thought we were going to be point counterpoint on this one, though, Christy. You know, first off, this was research that was presented at a meeting, so it hasn't undergone peer review yet, which is our standard sometimes. We like this research in some respects because it calls into question, is an x-ray needed? But the problem is, I think it's like always easier in hindsight to say, you know, you were driving to get to your destination, and by looking at the map, you got there wrong. You know, we can get to a certain place, but sometimes the x-ray is, you know, not necessarily, we don't know in advance, is that x-ray is going to help us or not. So does that mean that these x-rays weren't beneficial? Were they not reassuring to the parents and the providers? Did they stop from getting other studies that may have been even more invasive? I don't know about that.
I think what it calls into question and what is important for us to consider is when we're in places where there are protocols, somebody has a cough, get a chest x-ray. Somebody has this, especially we're talking pediatric patients, that we really, as physicians and as families and parents, ought to be asking the question, is this going to change the treatment plan? And if it's not, and, you know, maybe the study was flawed, maybe whatever, but still, if it's not going to change the treatment plan, then we ought to ask, well, then why do it?
Right. And I guess one of the issues is 5% of these x-rays were positive for pneumonia. Could the doctors easily tell of the x-rays of the children they were doing them on which of those 5% were? If they couldn't, then perhaps you do need to do a certain number of x-rays because you can't always tell.
But were they were going to give an antibiotic anyway?
Yeah, I don't know.
They were going to treat it anyway.
Complicated question
then
here.
Why get the x-ray?
Complicated question, but certainly something worth talking about with your doctor. Let's talk about our very last research that matters about text messages. If you were taking a medication, Christy, do you want a text message from your provider every day for 2 weeks and every other day for 2 weeks and then weekly for 6 months to remind you to take your medication?
I do. Well, what I really want is just to set my phone. I can't remember to take medicines. If I've had to take an antibiotic, I mean, even if it's just twice a day, it is really hard to remember to take it. And that might be because my life is crazy and I'm not organized enough, but I know it's a problem for my patients too. So setting your phone alarm, or in this case, getting text messages, improves the chance that you're going to stick to the medication regimen. So, I mean, for me personally, I need some sort of reminder to get it done.
This was research that was in a journal called PLOS One, PLOS One, and a very good journal. And it was actually of 300 people who were given medications for blood pressure or cholesterol lower medications, and one got the text messages and the others did not. And only 9% of the people who got the text message group stopped taking their medicine, compared to 25% of those who didn't receive text messages, which would indicate, boy, this is a great thing. But there's lots of questions I have. This was a research study. It's unclear if this works the same way when we just kind of roll it out in our practices. And, you know, for myself, I don't really want those text messages. I find it invasive and intrusive and giving out private information and being used for other reasons. But I could see some people who would. So maybe giving people choices.
Right. Giving people choices or helping patients set up a reminder on their phone that they've set. That's not necessarily me invading into their phone, not necessarily a text message, but an alarm system. There are all kinds of ways to do this, but the point is that reminders do help.
Yeah, maybe I can take that medication once a week or once a month.
That's even better.
That's my kind of medication. Well, right. That'll conclude the research that matters. We've had a chance to talk about text messaging and whether or not you would want that to help you take medications.
About kids possibly being exposed to unneeded x-rays.
About ibuprofen being really quite effective for fracture pain in children.
And about this concept of men worrying about being too old to have kids.
Well, we'll take a short break, but when we return, we'll be talking with Deanne Seekins, director of the Durham Veterans Administration Medical Center, about quality medical care for our veterans. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. UNC Family Medicine's number 2 ranked national program is rapidly transforming healthcare through excellence in teaching, clinical care, and research. To participate in UNC Family Medicine's efforts to move innovative ideas into action, call 919-843-5112 or email yourhealth@unc.edu.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, Christy, we're talking with Deanne Seekins, director of the Durham Veterans Administration Medical Center, about quality medical care for our veterans.
Welcome, Deanne. Thanks for being with us.
Thanks for inviting me.
And tell us how your journey led you to this path of what is now overseeing one of the largest healthcare systems in our region. Where did it all begin, and where did you become passionate about taking care of veterans?
Sure. Actually, it began 30 years ago. I joined the VA in Battle Creek, Michigan, and my grandfather was a World War I veteran. And my parents were struggling with getting the right services for him because he was aging, he was frail. And I knew that we had a veterans administration in our town. And so I took my father and I said, you know, let's go out there. Let's see what we can find out about this healthcare system. And let's see if we can get my grandpa hooked up there. And so we visited and I was very impressed with the services that they had. And granted, this was 1984. And so my grandfather was admitted to the hospital. And I said, you know, I think I want to be a part of this. At that time, I was working in private sector. And I thought, this is a mission that I truly believe in. I was very young at the time. And so I joined the Department of Veterans Affairs. And I actually joined as a medical records technician. And at the time, I had, you know, young children. And I was going to school, and I just decided that the VA was going to be a career. I was actually headed down the nursing path is where I was going. And once I got into the administration and I saw that as administrators in the VA, you can actually make a difference and you can make a change, I joined. And 30 years later, this is where I'm at. After 8 VA medical centers, we've transferred all around the country. I also did a 2-year tour in a network office in Atlanta, Georgia, a year in VA central office, and now my husband and I have made our home here in North Carolina.
Well, I think North Carolina is better for it. So we're really glad to hear that. And I guess it would be helpful for us because when I was talking with Christy and really hoping that you would come on the show, the VA has been in the news in the last months to year for, you know, reasons that are difficult and real. And we'll talk about that some. But I told Christy I had been aware for a much longer period of time about innovation occurring at the Veterans Administration in a laboratory as one of the largest healthcare systems in the country, maybe the world. Tell us about the scope of services nationally. What are we looking at here? And also at the Durham VA that you direct, what's the scope of what you provide?
You're correct. The VA is one of the organizations that's extremely innovative. And I'm going to go back in time a little bit. In the early 90s, we went up with the electronic medical record. Way, way ahead of our time.
We did it 6 months ago.
Correct, correct. Private sector was getting up.
Before that.
I know. Big one, though, yes.
Was getting this up in the last year, 2 years, maybe at the most. And with our electronic medical record, we were able to instantly connect 153 hospitals. So if you're a veteran and you receive treatment in Florida and you travel to California, your medical records are instantly available. And so our providers then have access. They don't have to repeat tests. They don't have to expose the patients to additional blood draws. It just really causes and creates a coordination of care. The VA is also very innovative when it comes to research. As you know, we're a leader in not only the nation, but in our communities with our research projects. We're innovative in medical care. We have affiliations with schools such as UNC. We have affiliations with Duke here, North Carolina State, ECU. That's for my area here, but across the country, 100 of our medical centers have very strong affiliations with large universities. And through this, I believe both Christy and Adam told me that they did part of their training in the Department of Veterans Affairs. So we train about 75% of the residents who go through medical school. So when you think about that, that's a large number. And many of those providers come back and work for the Department of Veterans Affairs. We're on the leading cutting edge of pharmaceutical research, animal research. There's just a lot going on.
Yeah, I know my dad was awfully proud of many things, perhaps of me going to medical school, but one of the best ones, being a World War II veteran himself, was the fact that I had spent some time training in the VA. He did take particular pride.
Well, and you have a particular mission that we all as Americans can rally behind, take care of people who've dedicated their lives and risked their lives and dedicated in service to our nation. So everyone, and perhaps that's been a history that we can all feel proud of, and yet you've had all these sort of little things some big things in the news recently about that. How has that been for you in your community and in your outreach to be able to sort of tell what is true of what's imperfect any organization is, but also what is true and good about the VA?
Sure. The VA is a large healthcare system, and we are public, so anything that we do, we expect to be transparent. We expect for people to watch and see what's going on, to look at our performance metrics. And so I won't tell you that the recent media hasn't been at times frustrating, because it's only a piece of the story. And behind every number is a veteran. And one of the things that I feel very proud that the VA does is that we treat the veteran. We don't treat a group. We don't say, okay, everyone will receive this type of treatment because they all have such and such diagnosis. We say, no, let's look at this veteran and what do they need? You know, what are their mental health needs? What are their medical needs? What are their social needs? Do they need help with housing? And so we look at the person as a whole. And I think that knowing that and standing behind that has led our employees to feel very proud about what we do. As the director of the Durham VA, I told our employees, I said, just continue what you're doing. When we went through the media blitz, I said, we're doing the right thing for our veterans. Continue on, stay focused on the veteran, and we'll always do the right thing.
So if we were to think about what occurred nationally, at least as far as the kind of as providers, what we hear about is what our patients would hear about. And this concern over long wait times or access to care. As family docs, we're always worrying about access to care, and we have metrics to try to do that. Why do you think these issues came up the way they did nationally at different VAs? And what, as a director of the Durham VA, did you feel that it was your job to try to do to ensure that this problem was going to either be dealt with or wouldn't occur in areas that you really oversee?
Right. And I'll speak for our network area. We cover 8 hospitals in our network. And since 2004, we're the largest growing network for unique patients and patients seeking VA treatment. We've grown since 2004, 41%. So when you think about a 41% growth in unique patients, that's significant. We have continued the journey. We've been on the journey to add additional primary care teams, to add additional specialty care. Congress has been great in supporting North Carolina for additional health care centers. So there's a lot of infrastructure, but as you know, you can't turn it on overnight. It takes time. It takes planning. So for us, what we have done is we've worked very close with our affiliations, with our agreements that we have to share the resources so that we can ensure that veterans are seen in a timely fashion. Are we where we want to be? No, because our growth is significant. I will tell you that we have many, many access points. I'll take a mental health patient, for example. We have an access clinic that runs Monday through Friday, and it runs till 8 p.m. at night. Veterans who need us have immediate access. Then we also have a psychiatric evaluation clinic that runs 24/7. Thank you. And so our veterans who have crisis or immediate needs always have access to us. We have at Durham VA the third busiest ED department in the country. So we're seeing many, many veterans. We have about 700,000 visits a year. So access is real. But I can tell you that our clinicians and our administrators really look at ways to ensure that we have slots built in, extra slots, so that we can see patients in a timely fashion. And if not, we partner.
Nice. Mm-hmm.
It sounds like you're doing a lot to improve the problem that exists everywhere with access to care, particularly around primary care and mental health. We do need to take a short break, but when we come back, we will continue talking with our guest, Deanne Seekins, director of the Durham VA Medical Center, about quality medical care for our veterans. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine. Now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with Deanne Seekins, director of the Durham Veterans Administration Medical Center, about quality medical care for our veterans. And Deanne, as you think back, you know, you said you've been in for several decades now, this kind of increasing level of responsibility and engagement and passion for caring for veterans. And if I asked you 15, 20 years ago, what would have changed? What did you think would be on the horizon? I doubt you would have said, well, I think we're going to have two wars that we're going to be involved in society, and this huge growth in people that we're serving, and this huge growth in things like post-traumatic stress disorder. What have you seen, and what's been the most surprising and maybe even gratifying things that you've been able to do and the VA has been able to do?
Right. I think there's a couple of major changes from when I joined the VA 30 years ago. One is at that time, the veteran population for females was about 1% to 2%. And now across the country, it's 10% to 12%.
Wow, shocking. I wouldn't have known that, and that's amazing.
So that is something that the VA really had to change quickly, because we didn't have the modalities of treatment for female veterans. We now have, with the two wars, we have a much younger female veteran who is coming back with, as you say, some with post-traumatic stress disorder. Many of them are coming back, and they're still in their childbearing years. So we get them linked up with the community, because we do not provide OB care. And so we're overseeing, I believe last year we oversaw about 250 deliveries of moms and treating them for their mental health and their medical conditions, whichever is appropriate, whatever they needed, before, after, and continued care. So that's been a significant change. You mentioned PTSD. When I began in the VA, the Vietnam era veterans, they were getting diagnosed, with PTSD. However, there was not the treatment modalities that there are now. But research has played a big part in the treatment now for PTSD that we did not have back then. There's a lot of neuroscience research that's going on. At the Durham VA Medical Center, we have about 500 research projects, and many of those are neuroscience projects that are underway. We attempt and take clinical research and apply it to everyday medicine, because it's one thing to have a research program, but it's another thing to apply those sciences. So with traumatic brain injury, with post-traumatic stress disorder, we are one of the centers who has a research center that's just for behavioral health. And I think that we set national precedence through these research projects. One of the items with post-traumatic stress is years ago, they didn't realize there were so many layers that you can't just treat the PTSD. You have to identify what other complications are going on. Are there substance abuse? What other things are happening with that patient so that they can treat it one layer at a time and ensure that we again, look at this veteran as a whole and as an individual.
And in thinking about both the individual and populations, you've got this population of people who is at higher risk for PTSD, depression, suicide, traumatic brain injury, and other things. What does the VA do to screen people and to identify the right people and hook them in with the right resources?
Right. That's a big piece of what we do. Every patient who comes to the Department of Veterans Affairs has a depression screening or screening to see if they're at risk. If they're identified as high risk, then there's a more in-depth screening that occurs, and we immediately link them up with the appropriate services. One of the things that we have done over the last 2 years is we have the primary care treatment teams, which in private sector, it's known as the medical home model. Mm-hmm. In VA, we call it the PACT model. In that PACT model, we have integrated mental health providers. So if you come in and your primary care provider screens that possibly you had the loss of someone, you have something going on where maybe you need some quick intervention, the mental health providers are right there in the same area. And so they can say, you know what, while you're here, I'm going to have Dr. So-and-so come in and just have a chat with you or assess you, because it's much easier to take care of the veteran right there when they're with us, mm-hmm, than asking them to come back into a mental health appointment. So that's been a huge change for us. In every one of our outpatient clinics, we now have integrated mental health right in there with the PAC teams.
That's fantastic.
You know, and it's sometimes so much harder even in the environment in which Christy and I and most of our colleagues operate on to get a mental health care on site. But we're really looking at these models, and here you have one. You know, you started talking about kind of the experience that got you into this business, I'm sure that running such a large system is a business. How do you stay connected with the experiences of those you serve? And what's been like, can you share any ways that you're able to stay connected and how that impacts on the work that you do?
I can. I will actually share a very personal story with you. My father was a World War II veteran, and he moved here to Durham a year and a half ago to be closer to me. And so I transferred his care from a Florida VA to the Durham VA Medical Center. And he became very ill in April and was actually admitted to our hospice unit at the Durham VA Medical Center. So as a daughter of a World War II veteran, I was able to walk every step of the way with my father as a veteran, see how our system worked, you know, see where there were areas that we could possibly improve, really view the things that we do well. And the hospice unit treated me like a daughter. They did not treat me like I was their medical center director, which I truly appreciated. And the night my dad turned very ill, they called me and said, you know, it's time for you to come in. And I got to experience something that I had always seen at our medical center but never could have that connection, and it was dying with dignity. And so I stayed with my father until he died that evening. 2 o'clock in the morning, the chaplain came in, and this is not just because it's me. He came in because that's what they do. Stayed with myself and my husband, and then when we escorted my father out, they draped my father in a flag. The chaplain carried the flag, and we escorted my father out of the VA with dignity and respect.
What a beautiful, beautiful story and image with that flag. Thank you for sharing that with us and our
kind of care that we want for any health system,
yes,
and particularly for those who have served selflessly for others in our country.
My father served in 2 wars, and I thought about this afterwards. Had he died outside of the VA, he would have never had that dignity and respect, that final walk.
Hmm. Well, you've talked a little bit about where the VA has come and some of the new challenges, and you as a female leader and thinking about caring for women and some of those changes. How do you look ahead to the future of the VA and what you think the next steps are in improving care?
I think it's exciting times for the VA. I always look at challenges as an opportunity or a springboard for us to become better. And you're right, being a female leader has oftentimes had its challenges, but I look at my job is not only to lead, but it's to motivate, it's to inspire, and it's to empower. And so I have over 3,000 employees, and I like to think that they feel inspired and empowered. And there's very few times that I have to direct. So as long as we continue to lead the VA and focus on our veterans, it's exciting.
Well, I think that the excitement is contagious. I hope that those who are getting care at the VA will continue to participate with you and all of the staff on improving care and sharing those innovations with us. And I'm sure this collaboration between the community and the VA and the broader healthcare environment, these are huge, huge issues. So, on behalf of Kristen, I want to thank you for coming and being our guest and sharing your perspectives with your health's audience today.
And thank you for inviting me and allowing me this opportunity to just let the community know we're there, we're ready, and we want to serve.
Thank you. We've been talking with Deanne Seekins, director of the Durham VA Medical Center, about quality medical care for our veterans. Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns.
If you have a question you'd like us to address on an upcoming show, send your comments to yourhealth@unc.edu.
And let's have our fantastic executive producer, Erica Norrie, read us our House Call questions for today. Erica?
I'm an older woman who has around 20 medical problems. Some of my friends say I need to see a geriatric specialist, but I've been followed by the same family medicine doctor for over 20 years. I tell my friends that she specializes in me. I would prefer this type of specialist anywhere, anytime.
Thank you for sharing that.
That's sweet.
There's lots in there. And, 20 medical problems, but having one doctor who's followed you for 20 years, that's a pretty good track record.
Mm-hmm.
Something's going right there.
Yeah, there is great value in continuity. So whoever that's with, but having an ongoing relationship with a doctor over time who knows you and who you can feel like specializes in you, that has great value both to you personally and how you feel about your doctor, but also to the outcomes of your medical care. They're better.
There is value at times and at many times in getting consultation for a whole variety of reasons. Someone might have a complicated surgical issue. Mm-hmm. We consult with our pharmacist all the time to help us figure out best management for complicated multiple medications. So there could be a reason to actually have an appointment and evaluation with a gerontologist. I think if that's something that you're interested in or your provider's interested in, then you have this kind of conversation. A lot of times that may not actually be something that could be in your best interest, particularly if, you know, you are really have a good trusting relationship and you feel like you really are getting good care, because you may have some changes made that may or may not be things that you could agree with. You know, I think if you're interested, talk with your doctor.
Yeah, it might have value, but only if that's useful to you or your doctor. I completely agree, Adam. Let's take our next house call question.
I've been smoking cigarettes for 40 years. Yes, I said 40. While I would like to quit, I haven't been able to do so for more than a week. My doctor continues to offer support and medications, but this year he offered me a new lung cancer screening x-ray. I'm a little scared. I'm afraid that if it comes back negative, I will think that I can still smoke. My goal is to try and quit again in the near future.
Well, you've just...
That's complicated.
It's complicated. That's right. When there's a movie called It's Complicated, I think this is one of those ones. And it's kind of like, you know, you're kind of like playing both sides of the bet. You know, you're betting on red and you're betting on black, you know, because if it's black, if the x-ray is negative, well, that's what you want to see. But you're right. You may feel that you can keep on smoking. On the other hand, if it's red and it's positive, you might say, oh, I'm going to quit. But, you know, I take care of a lot of smokers, tobacco users in the University of North Carolina hospital who feel like, well, now that I have cancer, it's too late. So, you know, I think that we should separate these issues out.
I think so, too. And I would try to separate out. You say you're scared. Are you scared because of this whole dynamic over whether or not you'll quit? Or are you scared because you've been smoking for 40 years and this is a screening test for cancer? And to go through and be afraid that you sort of want to wait until you have cancer, until you will actually stop quitting, those are just, I feel like those are sort of thoughts, sort of poisonous thoughts that get in there to try to keep you from doing the thing that you want to do, that you need to do, that is the best thing for your health, and that is to quit smoking.
Yeah, you know, if we separate the issues out, this new lung cancer screening test, you may be the right age, the right person, the right health history that the data would indicate you would benefit. You need to have a conversation with your doctor about the kind of the good things about having that test and maybe any bad things about having that test, and then make that decision. Similarly, you really should have this conversation both with your doctor, maybe a tobacco treatment specialist, about really coming up with a quit plan. After all, what's the worst that could happen? You try. That's the worst that could happen right there. Or that you don't try, that might even be worse. So I would really work on both ends and then create a win-win.
Let's take our next house call question.
I have mild anxiety, which I've been able to control with small doses of Xanax just before bedtime for about 10 years. I've never had to increase my dosage or had side effects. Recently, my doctor was out of town, so I saw one of her partners, and she told me I must get off the medication because I could one day develop Alzheimer's. Is this really true?
Well, I don't know if it's true that you have to get off the medication or if you could develop Alzheimer's. These are questions, and they're good questions.
They are. So it is true that this medication, Xanax, is a controlled substance that people can get addicted to them, that as you get older, even the same dose you've been on for a long time might cause you side effects or dangers and risks of falling and other things. So as you get older, that medication becomes potentially more dangerous to you. And then we've got this study coming out talking about this association between taking more frequent or taking days of taking Xanax and other medications like it and a risk of Alzheimer's. So it's muddy that it's risky. It's true that it's risky, but it's not necessarily true that it's absolute cause and effect or that it will happen to you.
And it's certainly not a black or white discussion about what's the best thing for you. I think I'm a little concerned that this decision should probably be made with the doctor that you've had a long-term relationship with, not necessarily with a doctor who's seen you kind of substituting in, because that sounds like it doesn't take into account enough your unique health history, your unique feelings, and over what period of time, if you were to get off of it, you should get off of it. We have some concerns, but we certainly respect the fact that you're doing pretty well. That's a good thing.
Mm-hmm. So I would follow up. I mean, in that situation, sometimes you can have the sort of partner doctor just give you enough until your real doctor, your main doctor comes back, or just to wait until they come back and then have that conversation. It's a good conversation to have, and important that that partner planted the seed for
but
you to be fully informed.
Very last question, Erica.
I have lots of problems, including high blood pressure, diabetes, and kidney problems. Recently, my left leg started twitching so much so that I thought I was going to go crazy if I didn't move it. I've not experienced pain, and I don't think it's related to any of my medications. What do you think this could be, and should I see a specialist?
Boy, that's a tough question. That could be a long answer, and we probably don't have a whole lot of time. What are a couple quick thoughts, Christy?
Well, I had a couple thoughts. One is you can have restless leg syndrome during the day, so that could have been it. Some types of cramping, if you have your blood chemistries or electrolytes, can get off related to those blood pressure medicines. So thinking about your sodium and potassium and those types of things was another thing, and other vitamin levels came to my mind.
Yeah, and the third thing, so and we could easily check those things with laboratories, and you can do some stretching for the restless legs, the exercises. Also check with your doctor about the medications you're taking and any potential side effects, because all kinds of medicines can do all kinds of things. That's the starting place. Certainly go see your doctor, and thank you for that question. Thank all of our listeners for all of the questions today. They've been some really great questions.
Yeah, we hope we've addressed some issues and concerns on the show today that are important to your health. We want to share your questions and stories by emailing us at yourhealth@unc.edu. You can follow us online at yourhealthradio.org, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and get our health app by searching Your Health, one word, for a free download at the App Store.
We'd like to thank the University of North Carolina Department of Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare, for their sponsorship, and our guest today, Deanne Seekins. We hope you'll join us next time on Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein, and we'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
You've been listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, presented by UNC Family Medicine.